Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. August is often a time of intense weather, hurricanes and heat waves are right there. But the epic fire, burning fast and still mostly uncontained in Southern California, east of Los Angeles, and the floods in Louisiana, labeled the worst natural disaster since Superstorm Sandy, are way beyond the usual. With climate change, some fear this could be the new normal. How do we handle that? This hour on Point, fire and flood and how we cope or don't now. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you, your family, your friends in the thick of the fire zone, the flood path? If this is a new normal, how do we cope? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we'll talk with a reporter and climatologist in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and we will look at how American insurance companies are responding to big, costly new levels of threat and risk with climate change. But first, to the fires in Southern California. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is Sharon McNary, infrastructure reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Sharon McNary, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
We're glad you follow infrastructure. We really want to look at that, but give us the latest on this Blue Cut fire, where it stands.
Just got off the phone with the people who are managing the fire. The acreage is up to 31,659 acres. They don't know how many structures have burned. There's some good reasons for that. And it's only 4% contained, which means they've established a line around only 4% of the perimeter of this vast fire.
It's been a big year for fires in California, and this comes at on the tail of 5 years of drought. Is drought the number one cause here, Sharon?
No, it's a big contributor to how bad the fires are, but because we're in the fifth year of drought, everything's dry, there's not moisture in the soil, and so when you get a spark from a fire, from a natural or a man-made cause, the fire can be much worse, spread much faster, burn a lot hotter.
Here's Glenn Barley in the San Bernardino Unit Chief for CAL FIRE. That's the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection. Press conference yesterday said California drought has led to dry brush all over the county there, causing wildfires to spread quickly.
One of the things that we're seeing is that the fires are burning in a really unprecedented fashion. It's to the point where explosive fire growth is the new normal this year.
And here at a press conference on Wednesday, Michael Wachowski, Incident Commander for Southern California Incident Management Team 3, described the fire behavior that Sharon's talking about here, the Blue Cut fire.
The fuels are extremely dry and very explosive this time of year. And in my 40 years of fighting fire, I've never seen fire behavior so extreme as it was yesterday. Rapid rates of spread. We've had spotting up to a half a mile ahead of the fire.
Sharon McNary, what about the resources California has to fight wildfires? With fires in the north and the south, are they up to this?
They are. I mean, the state is full of firefighters. And what you'll see at a fire like this is fire engines that could be from Montana, from Arizona, from Nevada. They have strategies for bringing in a lot of equipment very quickly. In fact, what they have are teams that rotate in and out. Like this morning, a multi-agency team 4 is going home. Three is going home. Team 4 is coming in. And these are like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of equipment that just rotate in and out on a regular basis. They are spread a little thin, but they've got strategies for, you know, when you take an engine out of a rural station, another engine will come and back it up from another place.
And what about the evacuees? 80,000 ordered to evacuate. Do you know how many actually did? Does anyone know?
There's no way to really know that other than driving through neighborhoods, and you'll see the occasional car in a driveway or the light on in a house if the electricity hasn't been shut off yet. I mean, there is such a thing as evacuation fatigue. Back in 2003, there were two massive fires, evacuated the entire mountain, and people were very compliant in leaving. But they were out for weeks at a time. Their food spoiled, their houses were deteriorating, and nothing bad happened to their houses. And so after that fire, a lot of people made the decision that they weren't going to leave until they themselves felt in imminent danger. And that's still going on.
I'm looking here. Char Miller, who's an expert on wildfires, National Forest at Pomona College, saying, you know, people are really afraid of a new normal emerging here, saying these fires are a sort of new normal. And looking at the depth of disruption, says, you know, it took out the U.S. 15. We saw that. The electric grid runs up through this area. The aviation fuel comes in through here. And you've talked about this as a major transport conduit, really, for the whole country, Sharon.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the aerial photography of the fire going on, it looks like it's burning not that much of great importance. There's some houses, there's some industrial buildings out there, there's horse farms, but that disguises the fact that this is a pinch point for transportation, for the transport of gas, for the transmission of electricity, for the movement of cargo from the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach to Las Vegas and points east. It's really important infrastructure. This is how Los Angeles Basin gets to the east of the country.
So what,
and a lot of that's shut down.
What moves through there, Sharon? This is coming out of the ports of California. This is cross-Pacific trade and freight?
Yeah, there's a place called the Cajon Pass. It tops out at about 3,800 feet. The first railroad went through there in the 1880s. There's now four rail lines that run as many as 200 trains through there, up and over the pass every single day. And one of these trains could carry the equivalent of 250 truckloads. So it takes a lot of trucks off the freeway, but when it's shut down, they have to reroute those trains through other places. And that's just not convenient. The most direct way east from the ports of LA, which carry goods from Asia, is through the Cajon Pass. And it's back open northbound on the freeway, but the railroads, I think, were interrupted quite significantly.
Is California thinking about how to cope? Professor Miller's right, this is some kind of new normal, and surely this is not the only infrastructure that is vulnerable. Can you fireproof infrastructure, or do you have to move it, or how's the state thinking about this?
Well, I mean, do you really want to? Part of the problem that has led to more serious wildfires is the policies that were for decades going on of suppressing every single fire. And so what you ended up with was forests that were overgrown. That led to an infestation of bark beetles that were able to attack the smaller trees, which led to having forests of standing matchsticks that would burn very, very quickly. And I think some of the more recent thinking is to, you know, if it can burn without taking out homes and important infrastructure, you know, maybe let it burn and let the forest regenerate itself. Now, the area that's burning now is more scrubby. It's you know, if you like the desert, it's very, very scenic. But this fire is taking out a whole lot of stuff that hasn't burned in a long time. And so that fire kind of reduces the severity of future fires.
People looking at underlying conditions here very closely. Sharon McNary, standby at KPCC in Pasadena. With us now also from Sierra Madre, California, is Bill Patzert, climatologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Bill, thank you very much for joining us.
Good day, Tom.
When you look at the fires in California this year, when you look at this 5 years of drought, and you look at climate patterns, do you see an interaction, Bill?
Well, you know, the history of the American West is really written in great droughts followed by great fires. And it's an old story. This drought really began about 16 years ago. We have these multi-decadal droughts. Right now, there's 26 large fires alive and well and causing destruction across the American West. California, there's 9 big fires we're fighting today. And so in many ways, this is not that unusual. But what has changed over the last half century is that the population of California has quadrupled. And so my simple formula is more people, more fire.
More people, more fire. I mean, people are causing the fire?
Yes, as you, the interface between the wildlands and the national forests and the urban and suburban development, the more people you put in this interface, the more fires you have. About 95% of the fires in Southern California are accidentally or intentionally caused by people.
So, I mean, here we have some realities then. One reality is a lot more people than there used to be in California. The other is, I mean, this drought, of course, droughts come and go, but this has been a long and deep one. How do you manage this, Bill? That's a pretty volatile combination.
Yes, it's a very volatile combination. And, of course, Sharon made a very good point, is that, you know, in some ways, we fight too many big fires. And so the national forests and some of these wildlands are overgrown with fuel. And so by fighting big fires and not letting little fires burn out naturally, we set ourselves up for what we're experiencing here today in Southern California.
Here's among the 82,000 told to evacuate in San Bernardino. This is a woman named Marha. She's talking about her future. Uncertain, she tells ABC 7 News.
I think this is the worst that I've ever seen, you know, and it's kind of getting used to the idea of being homeless.
Sharon McNary, where are all those people who were evacuated? Are they headed back home yet, or they're still, where are they rounded up or spending their time?
Well, there are two evacuation centers set up. They tend to be not terribly well populated. Generally, people are going to follow the friends and family plan. Most people have secondary places to go to. Also, a lot of homeowner insurance will pay for the cost of additional living expenses if you're subject to a mandatory evacuation. So why do go to a Red Cross shelter and sleep on a cot if you can be in a hotel room? You know, there's lots of other places to go. And mostly these evacuation centers become points of exchanging information, looking for information about your home or registering yourself as an evacuee.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about fire and rain, epic fire and flood in California and Louisiana, the impact, and what all this may say about what is to come. You can join us this hour. Are you there? Are you seeing this? Are you hearing reports from friends and family? And what does it mean when once-in-500-year storms stack up like this across the American South, come crowding in such a short period of time? Are you surrounded by tinder, dry terrain, drought terrain? Do you fear a wildfire in your home turf? And if this keeps up, what are the implications for California, for Louisiana, beyond? Lots of fires in California this year. Paul Lowenthal, spokesman for CAL FIRE here, talked to the Associated Press on Tuesday, ticking off all the fires that have struck Northern California in the past year.
This town, this county, and the neighboring county of Napa have experienced a lot of fires over the last year. We've had the Valley Fire, the Rocky Fire, the Jerusalem Fire, and now the Clayton Fire. Napa County's had the Cold Fire. They had the Rag Fire.
And in the south, right now, the Blue Cut Fire. We've all seen the pictures. 80,000 ordered evacuated. Here's NBC's Adrian Arambolo describing the scene on Wednesday.
We can tell you that this fire has been unique in the sense, that, according to firefighters, that it essentially created its own weather patterns in certain places. Our cameras captured at least two fire tornadoes spawned in these conditions.
We're going to go to Louisiana in just a moment. From California, we have with us Sharon McNary from KPCC in Pasadena. Bill Patzard is a climatologist with NASA, joining us today from Sierra Madre, California. Sharon, Bill, lots of callers for the two of you. We're going to go to Louisiana soon. Grayson in Wakefield, Michigan. Grayson, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Ashbrook. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that I was a helicopter pilot for 30 years, and I fought some fires. And also flew in Alaska and saw a lot of the glaciers that went away. And so about 3 years ago when I retired, I started investigating the science and went to the National Academy of Science and the American Meteorological Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And for years, they've been telling us this is what's coming. And so I got really involved, and just recently, it's not just the coast. We have a very underpopulated area in northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin, and we had about $30 million worth of damage from 12 inches of rain that came down in a very short period of time. And what everybody, all the scientists say, it's simply too much carbon dioxide going into the air. It's holding the heat in. The heat's warming up the dry areas and drying them out, like in California, but it's also heating the oceans up, putting more moisture in the air, and so the normal areas that get rain are now going to get them in huge deluges. And this is not going to stop for 20 to 50 years after we quit putting more carbon dioxide in the air.
So let's be thinking. Let's get busy. Grayson, former helicopter pilot who's seen a lot from the air, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, if I may. Beyond fire country here, we're into flood territory, Louisiana anyway. Olivia in Hammond, Louisiana. Thank you for calling, Olivia. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that we're kind of feeling over here in Louisiana that it's starting to become the new normal, actually, because we had a flood a couple months, a few months ago, actually. It didn't get national coverage like it is now.
Yep.
But it still displaced a few people. And then this flood, I'm finding just in my Facebook feed, 10 of my friends have completely lost their homes. And a lot of the rescue efforts have been internal, like within just us rescuing each other and stuff.
So what's the conversation, Olivia? How are you talking about all this? You know, once you dry out and get a chance to think about it, Louisiana's had flooding, has had plenty of flooding for a long time, but if this is a new degree, what do you do?
It's very new. It seems as though I think there's going to be a new standard for, I mean, people might be moving, but I think us Louisiana people are too stubborn to move. I think we have too much love for our own state. I think there's going to be a new standard for building at the very least. I know my rent is going up just for flood insurance, even though my home is raised.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. But I think most homes are going to be, it's going to be a new standard where homes are going to be raised. Like, it's going to be a standard, like having a house on the ground is going to be seen as foreign, you know?
Yeah, just won't do. Raised higher up off the ground. Olivia in Hammond, Louisiana. We're going to talk more about insurance and the insurance industry, how it is watching all this. One more, and I'll take it back to Sharon and Bill. Diana is calling from London, England. Diana, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. I would like to commend to you and your listeners an article by climate change activist Bill McKibben in the latest New Republic, where he calls for a literal war on climate change. He describes the kind of rate and nature of destruction that's caused by climate change, compares that to what would occur if we were under attack by enemy forces. And he makes a terrific analogy with World War II in explaining what is required in response, and that would be total mobilization of all of our resources, I mean, huge investment in infrastructure, and just going all out as if we were at war with an enemy.
Diana, I appreciate your call from London, no less. Bill Patchard, how does that hit your ear in California? You've got a lot at stake. Sharon McNary reports on infrastructure. You've got a lot there. Is California doing all it can? Does it need the country, the world, to do more to help create conditions where these fires are less likely?
Well, Tom, let's get right down to it. Global warming is a fact. We're living in a warmer world. The great ice sheets are melting. Sea level is rising. And we're seeing impacts on ecosystems in the American West. You know, we have warmer winters in California, shorter snowpack seasons. Right now, there are 65 million dead trees in the American West. And, of course, that is fueling a lot of these fires. And what's projected is in a warmer atmosphere, there will be more moisture, and we can expect more extreme weather like we're seeing in Louisiana. And so the bottom line is that we have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. Because if we don't, and we don't do it very, very soon, is that it's going to be like getting hit in the head with a shot put. So global warming is the real deal, and it's having an impact all over the planet.
Bill Patzert with NASA, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, climatologist there, joining us from California. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Sharon, Can California invest enough alone to address the issues raised by all this fire?
Well, it's not just a matter of investments, it's economic policy. I mean, we've seen over the last 30, 40, 50 years, a massive movement of the population into areas that were formerly forest and desert. And those are decisions going on in local cities, boards of supervisors of counties. And, you know, I mean, the housing boom, the bubble and the bust, tons of people moved into these very inexpensive vacation homes up on the mountain at a time when it was too expensive to buy down in the flats. And now some of those are now year-round residents. So when you look at the numbers of homes burned, a lot of those homes are homes that might not have been there, but for decisions of our local governments, putting them in that area between, you know, the more populated areas and, yeah, and the forests.
Lots of realities colliding here, not least in California, where the Blue Cut fire still rages, maybe 10% controlled. Sharon McNary at KPCC in Pasadena, thank you very much for joining us, Sharon.
You bet.
I want to turn to Louisiana. The flooding there has been pretty epic. The Red Cross is now calling the flooding in Louisiana the worst natural disaster since Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, at least 13 dead, 40,000 homes damaged, part of a wave of 500,000-year storms that have been hitting the South like popcorn. It wasn't so many months ago that we had South Carolina with its own record levels of rain and flooding across the state. This is last October, Governor Nikki Haley talking about just how rare this was, but there it was in their lap.
We are at a 1,000-year level of rain in parts of the Lowcountry. What does that mean? We haven't seen this level of rain in the Lowcountry in 1,000 years. That's how big this is. That's how South Carolina is, what South Carolina is dealing with right now. The Congaree River is at its highest level since 1936. That's why we keep telling people, stay off the roads.
Now it's the storms in Louisiana that have led to epic flooding there. Talking with the AP yesterday, Red Cross spokesman Craig Cooper said, despite the enormity of the disaster there, many people feel they've been overlooked.
The Red Cross sees this as our biggest disaster response since Superstorm Sandy. People are concerned, and we've heard this many times from people here in the Baton Rouge area, that they feel that no one really knows what's going on.
And we had this great clip yesterday on NPR from Larry Lee, maybe you heard it, in Sorrento, Louisiana, about what it's like to actually try and confront this. Just one man and the houses of his sister and a friend, his mom, and how nature can just overwhelm efforts when it gets this big and bad. Here he is talking about the futility of fighting this flood, this storm, Larry Lee.
The same bag, the sister's house, it went under. The same bag, the friend's house, it went under. After my mom's house went under today, I gave up. I mean, ain't nothing else I can do.
What a great clip there from NPR. With me now from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, right in the heart of all this, is Sue Lincoln, reporter for the NPR station there, WRKF. Sue, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to do so, Tom. Sorry about the circumstances.
Yes, we all are. First of all, do you all feel you were ignored for a while there before people took on the scale of this flooding, Sue?
Well, a lot of people do. I mean, I've been through many of these storms, usually with names. And in general, we believe that the lack of attention were other distractions, the Olympics going on and that sort of thing. But the fact that we didn't have time to prepare for this as we normally do, because it wasn't like a hurricane where we ended up having a name, we had a storm track we were watching. We had been warned that we were going to have epic amounts of rain and that flooding was a possibility. So we weren't left without any warnings. As far as attention not being focused here, a lot of people have said that, but just like we couldn't get out, a lot of the outside news agencies couldn't get in.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what's the state of things now? We see some areas drying out, but that water's flowing somewhere. Are new areas flooding? And why was this so much more in the sort of middle of Louisiana than we're used to?
Well, it was because the heavy rainfall sat over the central part of the South Louisiana, an area south of I-10. It didn't come in from onshore as we had anticipated. And this system spun over us, kept drawing up more moisture from the Gulf, more moisture from the Atchafalaya Basin, and just kept raining water down on us, and it moved slowly toward the west. So we had everything from about the middle part of the state south got absolutely saturated. And when you have 3 days of that kind of torrential rain, it's got to go somewhere. It doesn't mound up.
No, it does not. We've got callers from your neck of the woods, and we're going to go to a climatologist there at Louisiana State in just a second as well. Very kind. But Zach is calling from Ponchatoula, Louisiana. Zach, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've seen it flood at my parents' house for the first time this year in 2016 in March. My parents have been there for 30 years. It's the first time I've ever seen it come across the road. They got a couple inches in March. They got a couple feet this time. And it's just going to keep happening. And climate change is a huge part of it, but another part of it is the way this area has developed. It used to be a rural area above New Orleans in southeast Louisiana on the North Shore.
Yes.
But as more people have moved here after Katrina, they've built more and more developments all along the I-12 corridor. The more concrete you put on the ground, that water can't soak in. The water can't spread out like it used to. And so it just rolls into rivers, and then those rivers, they overflow and they flood people.
You got more people there, more concrete there, Zach. What's the talk as people deal with this, your parents and others? Do they see this as flooding like Louisiana has always known, or do they see this as something different, something new with climate change?
Something brand new. My parents have been in their house for 30 years. They've never had water in their house. They've had it twice this year. It's only going to continue to keep happening. And the mayor of the town of Walker, just outside of Baton Rouge, said that he's going to sue the state and the federal government because of the way that I-12 was built through Walker. It was recently redone in the last several years, and the way that the infrastructure has been built on the North Shore has contributed to the flooding problem. And so the new interstate that goes through Dem Springs and Baton Rouge and the town of Walker, that contributed to the way that area flooded. And
so he wants to maybe bring suit there. Zach, I appreciate your call. I hope your parents' house dries out without too much trouble there. Of course, that is always troublesome. Sue Lincoln, please stand by at WRKF. I want to go to Barry Keim now. He's a professor of climatology at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. He's Louisiana's state climatologist. Barry Keim, thank you very much for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So here we are looking across the South, and the reporting is that this flooding in Louisiana is the eighth event since May of last year in which the amount of rainfall in an area in a specified window of time matches or exceeds the NOAA predictions for an amount of participation that will occur once in every 500 years.
Yeah, it's been a crazy event, needless to say. And to put some of these rainfall totals in our area in perspective, a 100-year event for our region is about 14 inches.
Yeah.
A 1,000-year event is about 21 inches. But we have 9 stations across Louisiana that exceeded the 1,000-year event. And in fact, we have several stations that are over 25. And we had 25 inches over 2 days now. And we have one station that comes in at 31.39 inches. Okay, that's twice what a 100-year event would be over a 48-hour period. And it's a full 10 inches over the 1,000-year event. I mean, that's just, it's mind-boggling. It's staggering. And so it clearly makes sense that, a lot of people who never dreamed they could even flooded in this particular event.
And this, after so many of these across the South, you're the climatologist. What's going on here, Barry?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, I know everybody's pointing to climate change, and of course, no single event tells you anything about climate change, really. But when you start mounting and putting together a series of these things over an extended period of time...
Eight in a year and change above a 500-year level, so far above a 1,000-year level at 9 stations in your backyard?
Yeah, it does raise some very, very serious suspicions. And this past year has just been absolutely insane. I mean, we had the flooding up in West Virginia. It affected the Saints training camp this year. I heard you guys talking about the South Carolina flood earlier. Texas has had a whole number of floods in the last year. It really has been a very unusual period in our history. And, the big question is, what's driving all this? And, climate change is certainly one of the things on the table.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about fire and rain. Epic fire and flood in California and Louisiana, the impact and what it may say about what is to come. A little bit later in this hour, we're going to look at the insurance industry and how it is very soberly looking at what may be on its way with climate change and how to respond to that. From Louisiana right now, we have Sue Lincoln. She's a reporter with WRKF in Baton Rouge. We also have Louisiana's state climatologist, Barry Keim. He's a professor at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Here was the state's governor, John Bel Edwards, at a press conference over the weekend saying everyone who's been asked to evacuate should, because these have been unprecedented floods.
What we know is we have record levels of flooding along rivers and creeks. And because these are record floods, we don't know how wide the water is going to get in those areas. We don't. This is unprecedented, so we don't have records that we can go back and see who all is going to be impacted.
And here's Christina Broad, a Baton Rouge flooding victim yesterday, talking with the New York Times.
Everything that I had is gone. Everything.
Were you here for Katrina?
Yes.
Was it? Yeah, obviously, if you're on this side, it wasn't that bad, but
It was nothing like this. It was a lot of displaced people, a big area, but this is a whole town just washed away overnight.
Let's hear straight from New Orleans. Carol is calling. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hello. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the patterns that are happening. I mean, Louisiana is a flat state. The entire state should probably have flood insurance. But the way politicians, even in New Orleans, they have readjusted these flood zone maps and have fooled people into believing they don't need flood insurance or their flood zones have changed. But, I mean, people, you know, who have their heads screwed on straight can see the pattern.
It's not a fun pattern to look at, but it's deep right now and wet right now. Appreciate your call, Carol. One more from New Orleans. Gabriel, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
There are a lot of, there's a really big race, Senate race in Louisiana right now. We're talking about climate change, how this won't, it doesn't look like it's changing. It looks like we're at a new normal. We have a major party that has some pretty high-placed folks that deny that climate change is really a problem. I think in a state like Louisiana, a deep red state, it's really disingenuous and irresponsible to say, well, we have these problems, we need to fix them, or we need to deal with the consequences of climate change without actually dealing with climate change. I think that politicians, especially on a national level, from these areas need to be really asked about this. How do you feel? These people in red districts are hurting from what's happening.
Do you think that the flood is driving Gabriel, is the flood driving that home to voters in Louisiana or not?
Well, as of right now, campaigning has really halted because this is so serious and so important, and it's very respectful, which I appreciate.
Yep.
I think we'll see what happens. I think it's going to be dangerous because anytime someone says, well, look, you know, let's make this about climate change, let's make this in maybe a more issue-based election, then you're politicizing a tragedy, which is difficult. But when this keeps happening, when you keep having these rains and you keep having these floods, at some point, it does have to be political. At some point, people are going to have to vote based on it.
I mean, if climate change isn't an issue, I don't know what is exactly. Gabriel, I appreciate your call. Sue Lincoln, Barry Keim, here's a listener writing in, looking at the floods, but also fire. James writes to us. He says, I was just in California, and you could literally see the flames from Highway 1 when driving through Big Sur. On the West Coast, one senses an environmental fragility that is really worrying. As the environment continues to change, I think we humans are going to be utterly amazed at how rapidly we'll start to reach environmental tipping points in places like California, Florida, Australia. At some point, he writes, we hopefully wise up, let the scientists, engineers, and technocrats get their hands dirty and try to fix things. The mendacious bastards in Congress, I have no expectation of ever displaying useful leadership on these issues. So, Lincoln, is climate change an issue in the politics of Louisiana?
To be honest with you, no. They will not discuss it. They will not bring it up as an issue. I mean, we have had lawsuits filed by local governmental bodies asking the oil companies to repair the canals that they dug into our marshlands that allowed those canals to become hurricane highways for storm surge. And the government of Louisiana has pretty much quashed those lawsuits any way that they can. I mean, and I do understand that the folks in California are suffering. I understand it probably better than a lot of people. I grew up out there. And I remember a time in 1978 where, living in Long Beach, California, you could go up on Signal Hill, which is a hill completely surrounded by the town of Long Beach, and look all around and see fires all around you encircling on the foothills of the mountains that encircle the Los Angeles Basin. So this is not the first time we have had this out there. This is not the first time we have had massive flooding here in Louisiana. I am not saying that that means that it should not be addressed as a climate change issue. Far from it. I am just saying that we know how to cope with it as best we can. And right now, folks that have been flooded aren't thinking about climate change. They're thinking about stopping mold and getting drywall and soaked carpeting out of their homes when and if they can get back in their homes.
Yeah.
As far as the flooding continuing, Tom, a town near Gaydon was ordered a mandatory evacuation this morning because the floodwaters continue to move south.
Keeps rolling. Sue Lincoln with WRKF in Baton Rouge. Thank you so much for being with us today, Sue.
Sure.
Barry Keim, yes, Louisiana knows flooding. I mean, we say that all along here, but then you remind us that we're seeing downpours here that are without precedent. 1,000-year volumes and more than 1,000-year volumes, one after another at stations around Louisiana. You know, when there's a flood, you've got immediate needs. You've got to get that drywall down. You've got to get the carpet up. You've got to, you know, there's a lot to do. But if we've got trends that push us further in that direction, Barry, at a certain point, you can kind of be overwhelmed by everything that has to do with the flooding if the underlying trend brings on more and more.
Yeah, I mean, Louisiana is already the wettest state in the lower 48. In fact, we're second only to Hawaii in terms of the average rainfall across the state. So we're accustomed to dealing with lots of rainfall, and we also have water all over the place. So water is an issue that we're constantly dealing with. So it's certainly an issue. I just wanted to make a comment based on some of the callers you had earlier. I mean, the flood records across South Louisiana in this event have just been absolutely crushed. I mean, we didn't just barely nudge over the previous record. I mean, we just crushed those records, beating it by, 10, 15, 20, 30% in some cases. And also, somebody is talking about flood insurance in South Louisiana.
Yep.
I mean, if you live in South Louisiana, you need flood insurance. End of story. I don't care where you live what you've done to your house. So those are some of the big issues that we're facing right now. I know climate change keeps coming up, but as Sue Lincoln just mentioned, people are pulling drywall. We're dealing with moldy carpets. And, I went for a run yesterday, and already some of the houses around where I live, people are already pulling carpets out of their homes. So, I mean, getting back into their houses is really, that's the topic that people are worried about right now.
Well, of course, the immediate is always right there. People have to live. At the same time, you want to see what's going on. Sometimes it's flood. Sometimes it's fire. Robert in Bastrop, Texas. Robert, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I lost everything in the 2011 fires, big, massive wildfire in central Texas. And we've had two fires since then, four floods. And the last fire came within a couple of miles of my house before resources from California arrived.
Like firefighting resources, yeah.
Yes, DC-10 and bulldozers from Georgia. And right now we have torrential rains that are creating the fuel for the next round of fires that we're probably going to see next year. And this is just the new reality. And I think there seems to be a willful political blindness on the part of state governments. They don't have any preparation for this, it seems. And it seems like the fact that they have to allocate resources from California every time this happens indicates that I believe yeah. the climate change issue is motivating them to not really do anything, as and I'm echoing what some of your previous callers have said.
Kind of paralyzed in the face of it. Robert in Bastrop, Texas, I really appreciate your call. Politicians may have some willful blindness here. Insurance companies, it's hard for them to do that. I want to turn and look at that. Barry Keim, Louisiana State climatologist at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. Thanks so much for being here, Barry.
Yes, my pleasure.
As people flee their homes to fires in California, floods in Louisiana, insurers are bracing for big payouts and grappling with how their industry is changing with global warming and extreme weather. Andrew Logan is a director at Ceres. It's a network of investors and companies, public interest groups focused on sustainability. They've been paying a lot of attention to how the insurance industry is responding to changing threats and risks. Andrew Logan, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So, are insurance companies riveted by all this action? Are they changing their actuarial tables, if that's the right word, about what to expect? How do they survive if they have mountains of claims coming in from 500,000 year storms back to back?
Well, it's really a mixed picture. I mean, you know, as you said, insurers are really on the front lines of climate change. And I think, you know, insurers who have really thought about this issue, who have thought about what a world of climate change unleashed really means, I mean, they do see this issue as a threat to the industry's long-term survival. But surprisingly, or at least surprisingly to me, those insurers are actually the exception at this point, and they tend to be mostly in Europe and elsewhere in the world. And I think among U.S. insurers, there is still a real sense of denial that is keeping them from doing what you think they ought to be doing.
Well, those who are really looking at it, what are they doing?
Well, I mean, you know, managing risk and helping society adapt to new challenges is what insurers have done for the last 100 years. You know, and I think with an issue like climate change, insurers are in a great position to be part of the solution. They can help society plan for more extreme weather. They have the models. They have the expertise. And I think if you look at companies like Allianz or Munich Re in Europe, they're putting huge resources into modeling, into making sure that they can really understand, how extreme weather is going to evolve going forward. You know, where are we going to see more wildfires? Where are we going to see more floods? Because right now those models are woefully out of date, and that's incredibly important. I think equally as important is that, you know, they are taking their message to Congress and policymakers. You know, if you're a Republican, maybe you don't want to listen to what Al Gore has to say on this issue, but I think you ought to listen to what a big conservative insurance firm is saying.
We understand how politicians might want to duck this because long-term issues are harder to take on. People feel near-term things more acutely. But insurance companies have responsibilities to their shareholders and their own long-term health. What would keep them from acutely following these trends? I mean, if they're not responding to them, maybe they don't believe it's happening.
Well, they do. I think they're taking a very short-term view. And I think in the short term, what they're doing is simply being reactive and pulling out of areas, pulling out of the Gulf Coast, raising rates, pulling out elsewhere along the coast, pulling out of high-risk wildfire areas. But, you know, that's a short-term solution and not a long-term solution. Eventually, they're going to be pulling out of essentially every market that they have available to them. So I think, you know, in the long run, it's in their interest to take a more proactive view, you know, work with their policyholders to help them, strengthen their homes and prepare for, you know, the new normal of more extreme weather that we know is here and coming down the road.
Maybe they've got a model that doesn't migrate well to a climate change era. I mean, maybe they just can't. I mean, how much can people pay for insurance? Maybe that's just not a viable business if we get too much fire and too much flood and the rest.
Well, that is the very real, you know, concern that the European insurers have, is that, you know, the whole model of insurance is basically moderate, predictable risk. And as we head into a climate change era, risk is becoming a lot less predictable and a lot less moderate. So, yeah, the real question on the table is, you know, is the world insurable, in a climate change future?
What happens if it's not? I mean, right now we've got government backstopping in a lot of places in California. I think the government there is a fire insurer of last resort. What happens when insurers pull out of particularly vulnerable areas?
I mean, the economy really slows down and even shuts down. I mean, I think people don't always appreciate just how much insurance makes the world go around. I mean, you can't buy a house, you can't buy a car, you can't start a business without affordable insurance. And so I think what we've seen already in places like Florida and other areas of the coast where insurance is becoming harder to get is that the economy slows down. And I think that's just a taste of what we might see in the future. So there's a real, so I think there's a lot at stake here, not just for insurers, but for everyone who has a stake in the economy as a whole.
A lot of ramifications. One more call here from New Orleans. Jerry. Jerry, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm an ecologist, and I fought fires in California as a young man, and I went through Katrina as an older man.
Okay.
I can tell you that there's extreme fire danger on the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, where the current flooding is, that is almost completely unrecognized. And I'd also like to point out that Sacramento is at higher risk of a catastrophic flood than New Orleans is right now.
So who's going to act on this, Jerry? Companies. Government, insurance companies? Who's going to start to really move?
Insurance companies will move first. They will start pulling out, or they'll start raising rates to the point where people just can't afford to stay there anymore, or they'll stay there at their own risk. And government is definitely a trailing indicator here. Insurance companies will make the call before anybody else does.
Sooner or later, money will talk there. Jerry, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Andrew, what do we look for to see the insurance companies really waking up and making changes? Or is it just bit by bit? They pull out here, they pull out there, they raise rates, and we don't really see a big move.
Well, no, I think at some point we're going to get to a turning point on this. I think, you know, the more extreme weather we see, the more losses we see, and the more unexpected losses we see, I think, you know, minds are beginning to change inside some insurers. And actually, we're seeing it, you know, almost in real time. You know, since 2010, insurers have had to disclose every year as part of this sort of mandatory disclosure process in the state of California. They have to disclose, you know, what they're doing about climate change, how they're impacted by it, how they view it as a risk issue. And you know, even since 2010, we have seen kind of slow and steady progress. Again, not where we want them to be, but beginning to turn in the right direction. So I think, you know, we're going to see progress first on things like models. Right now, again, the insurers are kind of flying blind because the models tend to look backward. They tend to miss things that are unexpected. So, you know, I think if we're not at a turning point, I hope we're close to getting there. And it's really just unfortunate that it takes disasters like the one we're seeing in Louisiana to make that happen.
Andrew Logan is the director at Ceres. It's a network of investors and companies, public interest groups focused on sustainability. Andrew, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much as well.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.